Good morning and welcome to the October 5th edition of Mountain Money. I'm your host, Roger Goldman. I'm here with my co-host, Kevin Kennedy, on a brisk fall morning here in Park City.
Good morning, everyone. Boy, yeah, it was cold. I had enough frost on my car.
And beautiful cloud formations in front of the mountains. And the best thing about this morning was the snow-capped peaks as we saw the results of this weekend's cold weather. Anyway, this morning, we're going to start our day by speaking with Professor Katie Keith of Georgetown University. She's going to be talking about the Obamacare premium tax credit issue that is one of the issues at the core of the reasons why we have a government shutdown.
Yeah, and then we speak with Hillary Ryder Azzaretti of Redhead Marketing and PR about all things marketing and PR. A lot of stuff there. Then we're joined by Trevor Searle and Bo Wagner of Apex Fire Preparedness about how they can get your home fire hardened. All this and more on Mountain Money. Stay tuned.
A central issue in the ongoing congressional standoff that has resulted in a shutdown of the federal government involves tax credits under the Affordable Care Act. On the phone to help us understand how these credits work and the issues presented by the changes in the law associated with the Big Beautiful Bill is Professor Katie Keith of Georgetown. Good morning and thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So let's start with some basics. How do the tax credits associated with the ACA work as a practical matter?
Yeah, so since the Affordable Care Act was put in place, there has always been some financial help for the monthly premiums that most people pay. These tax credits that you're mentioning are available on a sliding scale, so they're more generous for folks with less income and level off over time. Originally, these tax credits were available for folks whose income was just at the poverty level, up to about 400% of the poverty level. So for an individual, that's, you know, about $16,000 a year to $62,000 a year. For a family of four, we're talking about folks making, you know, $32,000 to up to about $129,000 a year. So that was the law as originally conceived, and that was what was in place for many years. But in 2021, Congress expanded these premium tax credits, made them more generous for the folks who were already getting them, and eliminated what we used to call the subsidy cliff for those who are middle income. Mm-hmm. So I just mentioned this, but you know, those tax credits fell off at about 400% of poverty. American Rescue Plan Act lifted that. And so folks above that income level under certain circumstances could qualify, and it really expanded, you know, eligibility and made premiums and health insurance under the Affordable Care Act a lot more affordable for many. I could get more into the details if it's helpful. Overall, what the law did was cap and mean that nobody should pay over 8.5% of their overall income towards premiums alone. And 8.5 is still pretty high for a lot of people, but that's essentially what the law did. And of course, that number's lower for folks who are lower income.
And when people hear the term tax credit, your instinct is to think it's going to be a reduction in the taxes I paid. But in fact, the way this works as a practical matter is it's a premium subsidy. It's actually from month to month, you pay an amount that reflects the fact that a number of dollars are being paid directly by the government to the insurance company. Have I got that right?
You nailed it. So it never even comes to you. It just means you pay less than you would have otherwise paid. And the insurance company is getting, you know, the proportion that the federal government's paying on your behalf. So it really reduces what you owe each month.
Okay. And we have the budget legislation of this year. How did things change?
So the budget legislation of this year didn't change this issue. I think it's most notable for failing to extend these enhanced premium tax credits that have now been in place for 5 years. The One Big Beautiful Bill Act, or HR1 as some people have called it, imposed a lot of other restrictions on the coverage, but really didn't get at this issue, which is why about, you know, how much do people pay in their premiums, which is why it's been a huge feature of the government shutdown and sort of how we got where we are today. I think this is something that could have been addressed sooner this year and is not, which is often how Congress works, waiting until there's a crisis to need to address something.
Okay, so We've heard, you know, you hear a lot about this in the popular press at a somewhat high level. Can we try to understand, let's dig in a little bit and see if we can understand what that would mean for some examples of how these changes would affect individuals or families of four at different kinds of income levels?
Yeah, absolutely. So we can give a couple different incomes, and I would give the really strong caveat, of course, that these are averages. We are waiting to see how all this shakes out, but and folks who rely on this coverage should go and check their own information, right? But one example that I thought was very helpful, if you were a, you know, 55-year-old couple who makes, you know, $85,000 a year, so two people, $85,000 a year, in 2025, on average, that couple is paying $7,200 in premiums, which is not small each year. It's about $600 a month. If and when these tax credits expire, this extra help that people have been getting for the past 5 years, if it expires, that same couple making $85,000 a year would pay $21,000 in premiums. So up from $7,200 to $21,000 in premiums next year. So jumping to, you know, close to getting to $2,000 a month, up from $600 a month. So huge implications. Yeah. Like, that's an example of a couple or a family who was getting some help under the new law, the, you know, recent laws, and it would now be getting no help from the federal government. They would sort of be left completely to their own to pay for these premium increases. For folks at the lower end of the income spectrum, the increases aren't as dramatic, but I think they will still be quite significant for families. And an example was a 35-year-old couple who maybe makes $30,000 a year. They have not been contributing. They've been paying $0 towards their premiums, given how generous this is, but their premiums would jump to $1,000. And maybe that doesn't sound like a lot to some people, but if you're only making $30,000 a year, $1,000 towards your premiums when you weren't paying anything is a lot. And I think if you look at how much food and other expenses and utilities and all the other costs that families are grappling with, a lot of people just can't absorb these higher rates for 2026. And so the expectation is we will see a lot of people drop coverage altogether or go without. So we'll see more people be uninsured as a result of this. And you will see the people who stay in these markets will be the ones that have high healthcare needs, right? The people who haven't, you know, maybe have cancer or have a chronic condition or some kind of thing where they know they're going to need healthcare. So they're the ones willing to pay $21,000 in premiums or $1,000 in premiums. And what that's going to mean is, you know, the healthier people will fall out. The people who are maybe sicker than average will stay in. And then that's going to cause your premiums to increase more over time. So it kicks off kind of a bit of a vicious cycle there too, which I think is important.
Right. So let's go back to the 55-year-old couple. So it goes up to $21,000 a year, and that's just their premium. Do they have deductibles and out-of-pocket maximums?
All of that's on top. You're exactly right.
So therefore,
premiums plus.
Yes. So if they are unhealthy and they stay with it, they're talking a whole bunch of money, and then the premiums go up, and then the deductible goes up, and now it's about 50% of their income.
That's exactly right. And again, right now, folks paying $7,200, that same couple, that's not small either. But the idea of absorbing so much more is just going to make it impossible. And so if they don't have healthcare needs, they're probably not going to be able to afford that. And so they'll drop the coverage, which is not, speaking for myself, what I want. I think people should have good, you know, high quality health insurance, so it's there when they need it. And I guess one other sort of macro point beyond these individual examples, and again, folks should, you know, assess what their own needs are. You know, these impacts are going to be felt the most in states where premiums are the highest or in communities where premiums are the highest. And so this will sort of disproportionately impact people who are older and people who live in rural areas, and then especially those who are above, who would now newly be under that subsidy clip. So those who are middle income, above 400% of poverty. And the reason is, you know, the way these tax credits work, the higher your premiums are, the more help you get. And as the help falls off, Those are the exact type of consumers who are going to be forced to shoulder more of the burdens here. So again, rural farmers and ranchers, it's about a quarter of farmers nationwide rely on this coverage. It's a lot of small business owners. The impacts are going to be pretty broadly felt by a lot of parts of the community, but I would say it's especially going to be high in rural, middle income, older areas with older Americans too.
And let's go back. We went through some things that I think are pretty interesting, and we went through them pretty quickly. So is there any sort of projections about the number of people that, because of this increase, are likely to say, look, I just can't afford it, and are therefore likely to go out and go uninsured?
The estimates have pretty consistently been about 4 million people will go uninsured or won't have coverage because if these enhanced tax credits are not extended. And again, I think it's worth saying this has been the case for the past 5 years. Folks have really come to rely on this coverage. Mm-hmm. I am not enough of a data person. I'm a lawyer, not a data person, to know if that is a conservative estimate. And we would actually see much more significant implications, especially when you add on some of the other changes in the One Big Beautiful Bill Act that were put in place. This could get sort of worse over time. And as we're watching the economic indicators, I'm personally quite concerned that you might actually have more people if folks get laid off or there's changes in the job market. Historically, you know, there's been a really soft landing place through the marketplace coverage for people to get insurance. And if, you know, the coverage there is not as strong, I think maybe we could lose even more people than that. But I guess that remains to be seen.
And again, that phenomenon that we've seen in the past or that is predicted of if the people who are most likely to drop out are the people who are younger and healthier. And that, and again, why does that have an impact on premiums in the future?
Yeah, it's a great question. You know, the ideal insurance market is, you know, healthy people and sick people is as big as possible. We want as many people there. And so that you can help keep, you know, spread costs of the sicker people across everyone. And as you get into a system where the coverage is too unaffordable, that the sort of younger and healthier people just can't afford it or say it's not worth it, and they fall out, you have a market that will just be spread across a smaller and sicker risk pool. And so the insurance companies will want to cover the costs of the care that they're, you know, offering. And so they will raise premiums. And so it can become this cycle. And then when premiums raise again, more
people drop out.
Healthier people fall out. It becomes this, you know, ongoing sort of spiral there. And so it's been something that I haven't made this point yet. You know, these enhanced tax credits, these laws put in place, they've been wildly successful at bringing more people in. So we've seen a doubling in the enrollment since these tax credits were offered, from 12 million to 24 million Americans right now relying on this coverage. And it is, the data shows, is a lot of these healthier, younger people who have come in. And I think that we've sort of known that for a long time. It's not that younger and healthier people don't want insurance. They do. They just need it to be affordable. And so this is, these changes that are about to expire have enabled, I think, a lot of younger, healthier people to come in. And that's why you would see this kind of risk pool dynamic that you've highlighted would contribute very much to the, you know, increased number of people dropping out of the market. But it would also mean higher costs for those who remain. So those couples that we just talked about, you would see premiums grow even more.
Now so that's these 4 million people who will be dropping out. Now, are they dropping out on their own, or are they being pushed out because they don't meet the financial numbers?
That's a great question. I think the estimates are those are the people who would decide to go uninsured or simply couldn't, because they couldn't afford it, because it wouldn't, you know, they would no longer be able to pay their portion of the premium as the premium tax credits shrink down.
And if these are younger, you know, 30-year-old healthy individuals, they must help the government keep the costs down right now. So therefore, anything that the government's giving, not only will the people be paying more in premiums, the government will have to pay more in premiums.
That's exactly right. The Congressional Budget Office recently did a new analysis that said if Congress extends these tax credits, it will cost money to the government, right? Because they are paying premiums, but it will actually show drops in the premiums overall because of exactly what you said and the, we'd call it the risk pool implication. So premiums would go down by about 8% each year if these were permanently extended because more healthy people would be coming into the market. And so, you know, I think there's some ideological opposition to extending these tax credits, but I think a lot of the indicators of more people covered, premiums go down. It does cost the federal government something to do that, but it, to your point, it also maybe costs not to do it in other ways too.
Now, we talked a little bit about that. You just mentioned the potential for premiums to go down. As we're setting this up, do we know yet the extent to which gross premiums, that is the amount that is the total cost of the policy before any tax credits, is there any indication about how much that's going to go up and how does that add to this picture?
Yeah, it's a great question. So premiums are rising in general. We have, so far, we have talked about the portion that consumers pay, which I would call the net premium, but the gross premium, you're exactly right, is rising. I think the last data I saw on this was on average nationwide. Of course, there'd be some variation. The gross premiums are rising about 18% this year, which is one of the biggest increases we have seen in about a decade, I think, since the Affordable Care Act might have been put in place. Part of that 18% is being driven by the loss of these, you know, enhanced premium tax credits that are being thought about right now. But there's other factors too. And colleagues of mine at Georgetown have dug in deep in all the different rate filings and looked into, you know, what are the insurance companies saying about the prices? And so there's factors like tariffs, for instance, sort of the overall cost of healthcare prices, prescription drug, things that are sort of normal and that we think about and some that are unique to this time. I think the expiration of these enhanced premium tax credits was driving at least 4% of that premium increase across the board. So there, you know, and so for people who, and I, that number, this 18% is hugely important for those who don't qualify for any of the financial help I am talking about. And especially for those at that, if we have this 400% of poverty cliff again, so if you were sitting at 415% of poverty, like, I don't know, $65,000, $67,000, you would be on the hook for everything you were paying, everything the government was paying on your behalf before, and whatever portion of that 18% increase in your states too. So folks will just be paying a whole lot more costs.
And so when we did those numbers earlier, were those numbers, when we talked about the potential impact, were those numbers prior to taking into account the gross premium increase, or were they, or did they sort of include the net?
The one I gave for the 55-year-old couple making $85,000 a year did not. So that couple would pay an additional $3,700 if this 18% gross premium increase is factored in. So that's where you would see. So the total numbers, right? That's a family paying $7,200 now for this year. They could see, be on the hook for $24,000 next year in total, jumping from about $600 a month to $2,000 a month. And again, if folks are sick, they might really have to scrounge together to figure out how to pay for that. But a lot of families making $85,000 a year are not going to be able to spend $25,000 on their health insurance premiums alone.
No, no one's crunching these numbers. I mean, no one takes into account $85,000, and let's say they're doing 25% to their housing. I forget what percentage is food. The numbers just don't add up.
Which is why, you know, I think this seems to be the fight that Democrats in Congress have
chosen. Yeah, and
that's where we are.
And that leads us to our next question, which is the enhanced premium subsidies expire at the end of the year. Why is this fight happening now?
It's happening now in part because open enrollment, the annual time where people, you know, come in and enroll for the next year, begins on November 1st. And, you know, the normal process of things is the insurance companies are trying to finalize their premiums right the second. We have all these indicators, but if Congress were to come to an agreement here, I think those could be adjusted quickly and you could avert some of the crisis that we're talking about right now. But those have to be baked. Those have to be ready by November 1st so people can start to enroll. And frankly, if these are not getting extended, you want people to have as much time as possible to make these decisions and to really understand the implications. Also in the next few weeks, insurance companies and the state lease marketplaces are going to start sending notices to consumers about know, here's what your premiums will look like. Here are the changes. And so as people get, you know, this mailer in their inbox saying your premiums are going to increase by X percent, as we've been discussing, I think there's a huge concern that, not that you couldn't add the premium tax, you know, sort of add the money in at the end, but people reading that letter when you open it are just, I think the big concern is people are going to walk away. They're going to say, there's no way I can afford this. They won't come back to the marketplace. They won't get notified necessarily, even if Congress does take action by the end of the year to revert this. And so the concern is you're going to lose people between now and then when these notices go out, which I really think is why this is the fight that folks are having now. So trying to really avert those losses ahead of 2026. And sorry, I should declare to avert those coverage losses. The timing really does matter here. It's not one of those benefits that just kicks back up in January, because people have to make decisions before then and need to know what they're working with and what their budget should be. People try, you know, a family's trying to do the right thing to plan out, you know, their finances for the next year, really need to know this information as soon as possible.
On a slightly different topic, we've heard a lot in the press about the shutdown somehow being tied to a proposal to spend billions of dollars providing health care to undocumented individuals. Can you explain the facts on that issue?
Absolutely. Thank you. And I'm glad you asked about it. So undocumented people are not eligible for Affordable Care Act coverage. They never have been, and that's never been an issue. Historically, the law has said lawful immigrants, some can be eligible. And so we're talking about refugees, asylees, people who have fled human trafficking, but everyone, green card holders, people who have a legal
presence.
Right to be here. So it's never been available for undocumented people, first of all. I will say, even what I just said about lawful immigrants, that was something that in the One Big Beautiful Bill Act will be changing beginning in 2027. So Republicans in Congress closed that eligibility too. And so refugees, asylees, and other categories will no longer be eligible. So, but setting that aside, I think a lot of the discussion about undocumented immigrants comes from an effort by the Democrats to also push to reverse some of the Medicaid program changes that have been made. And there too, undocumented people are not eligible for Medicaid. I think they have been pointing to programs like requiring healthcare providers to, you know, treat anyone who comes in the door, that kind of thing, and claiming that is an effort to, you know, fund undocumented people's healthcare, that kind of thing. So it's I would certainly, for all these programs we are talking about, undocumented people are not eligible.
Okay, we've been speaking with Katie Keith, professor at Georgetown University, about the premium subsidy issue associated with the Affordable Care Act. Thanks for explaining what is a fairly complicated issue to many of us.
I'm very glad you all asked, and thank you for having me.
We'll be right back after this.
Many of us have a friend, neighbor, or an acquaintance who has ditched the corporate life, struck out on their own, and worked directly with and for their clients. We are continuing to speak with some of these trailblazers on this show. Our next guest is one of those. So let's say you have a product to sell or a service to offer, but getting the word out there to find customers is not exactly in your wheelhouse. That's when you call in a marketing specialist. Hillary Ryder Azzaretti has been at the helm of Redhead Marketing for many years. We're lucky to have her on our show. Good morning and welcome to Mountain Money.
Thank you. Good morning, Kevin and Roger.
Can you take a moment and tell us about yourself and what led you into marketing?
Well, I am a New Yorker who moved to Park City back in 2001. And my career had started in the music industry, working for major record labels in New York, working in PR. I even had my first PR internship for a music boutique PR agency when I was 15 or 16 years old. So I was very passionate about music and public relations. And I love the process of PR and earned media. You're not buying an ad, you are actually getting credible news attention for your clients, and you have to be really creative and come up with those story angles that will resonate with both reporters and their readers. So Once I moved to Park City, that was for working in the press department of the Sundance Film Festival, which was a really great opportunity to come here. I was a big independent film fan, a big skier, and so I thought I would be here for 3 months. And then one thing led to another, and I had various visible PR roles here in the community. Eventually went to work for a small marketing and PR agency where I met you, Kevin, initially, and then went out on my own during the recession, which was a pretty scary time.
That was a rough time. Absolutely. That's a rough time to go out on your own.
It was. It was 2010. We were in the depths of the recession, and I felt like I could better serve clients than I could within the confines of a traditional marketing and advertising agency. And I just wanted a lot of variety in my work. I worked for a very niche business before that. And now after 15 years, I get to work with so many different industries and no 2 days are the same, which makes it really fascinating.
And you get to pick and choose who you work for.
I do. And I feel I can offer much more personalized attention to those clients when you're not within the restrictive environment of a larger agency. And we can offer them much higher level expertise as well.
Were you beating yourself up in 2010 saying, what am I doing? Why am I leaving this job? It's rough.
Well, first of all, I didn't have a lot of choice because I was laid off, like a lot of people were in 2010. And I really hadn't intended to go out on my own, but jobs were few and far between. And I had some interviews, but really with no opportunities that spoke to me or resonated. And people started reaching out to me for some small freelance projects. And then that continued to grow to the point where I didn't even have time to go for a job interview. And then all of a sudden I discovered I had my own business.
So a challenge became an opportunity.
Exactly. It was very organic. And looking back, I wouldn't have had it any other way.
Okay. So tell us a little bit about how your organization, do you have an organization? How many people do you work with? And, you know, how do you sort of build a structure?
So my intention was to be the complete anti-agency. And so we don't have a multi-layered structure. I don't have full-time employees. I am the only employee of the business, which is an S-Corp. And I work with a very small team of highly specialized independent contractors. And so this makes it very scalable. We have no real overhead, so we're not passing a lot of our bloat and costs off to our clients. And they're also working with seasoned experts instead of junior staff, which was always a frustration of mine when I was on the client side and I was managing outside agencies and working with 22-year-olds who were right out of college, being trained on my employer's dime, mm-hmm. and then having to deal with a new account manager usually every 6 months and having to get somebody new up to speed. So nobody has to do that with us.
So since 2010, what would you say is has been your biggest challenge?
The biggest challenge, I would say, initially was really determining our rates and sticking to them and increasing those rates over time. Mm-hmm. I think women tend to have this challenge more than men do, where we don't appreciate our value and our worth that we bring to the table. So I know that our rates are very competitive and we certainly charge less than larger agencies do and deliver more and faster for our clients. But being able to justify those rates verbally has been a challenge. And I think that's one that at this point I feel much more confident with than I did early on. And then, of course, another challenge is being able to identify story angles for clients that will resonate with media. And you know, that just takes a lot of experience and instinct that evolves over time. But that's a fun challenge that is an ongoing one.
Your job is fun.
It is fun. Like I said, no 2 days are the same. And you know, we're very passionate about the clients that we work for. And our success is very much tied to theirs.
So let's try to explain a little bit about how a project would work. I mean, I'm a lawyer, right? So somebody gets sued, they came in, I know what to do. Like, we go to court, we deal, we reach a resolution, hopefully we win. What does somebody come to you and ask you, and how do you build a project?
Well, first of all, I wanted to be a lawyer, but I was afraid of the LSATs. But
wise choice.
So really we begin by thoroughly deep diving into what our client is all about, who their audience is, what their brand story is, what their messaging is, and develop a PR plan and a strategy that will yield successful results and news coverage. And of course, we want to identify what their objectives are. There are various reasons why a company wants to engage in public relations. And so it's really important that we're always keeping that in mind and knowing what that objective is.
Okay, so let's take it down a level. I'm having trouble following it. Give me a typical client and what they want.
So typically a client wants to see their name in the news. They want to establish thought leadership, credibility. They want to rank in organic search results. They want to drive sales or leads for their business, depending on the nature of the business. So there are various reasons for wanting to do public relations, and so, you know, sometimes it's all of those reasons. And these days there's a new, very big reason, which is the proliferation of ChatGPT search results and other large language models like Claude and Perplexity. And the importance in appearing in those results relies heavily on earned media coverage in authoritative news sources.
So someone can't wing that themselves.
Well, PR stands for public relations, and the relations is the relationship component of our business. So having been in business for 16 years almost and being in PR for way longer than that, we've cultivated some valuable relationships with news media that helps us get these stories placed for our clients.
Okay, so you just mentioned the large language model.
I don't even know what that means. Why don't you stop by explaining what that means? Yeah.
So large language models are tools that we're all using these days, like ChatGPT, Claude, Perplexity, that are giving us information. And that information that we're getting, sometimes people are going directly to ChatGPT to research a topic, or they're going into Google and they're entering a question or a keyword. And what we're seeing these days, what ranks higher than website results are the ChatGPT or Google search responses with information. So now people aren't even clicking on websites anymore in their search results. They're getting the information they need from large language model LLM. And so these LLMs are scanning the web to get trained to regurgitate those search results to users. And 90% of the sources that they're scanning are authoritative news sources. So those would be media outlets like the New York Times, Newsweek, Wall Street Journal, CNN, and even on a smaller scale, local media outlets as well, like KPCW.
Yeah, Local News Hour.
Now when I do a search on Google, okay, what first pops up is what it calls AI results. Is that what you're talking about?
Yes, it's
AI
results.
And I look down there and they'll have little things, and then there'll be a little bubble at the end, and a lot of times that will link to a news story. So your new object of your game is to try to make sure that your client and their stories tend to pop up in that top part more often.
Exactly. Because people are going directly to that as their source of information instead of scrolling down further on the page to click on a website. And obviously there still are people going to websites, which is why your organic SEO is still important and media relations is important for just as much for organic SEO as it is for AI search results.
Yeah, so this is a, I don't want to say a shortcut, but it's how you get to the top of the search page.
Exactly. Whereas, you know, 15 years ago, people were identifying the need for media relations for those organic search results. And now we're seeing the demand for public relations in response to these LLM search results.
What would you say is your ideal client?
I would say the ideal client is one that appreciates the importance of public relations and understands that it's an investment not just in money, but in time. You can turn on a Google ad with pretty much the flip of a switch and get immediate results. Public relations is more of a long game, but it is a completely worthwhile investment in terms of building your credibility, your authority, your thought leadership, and driving leads for your business.
Let me ask you this. If I had been Rob Katz and it was December of 2024, and I'd said, I got this little PR problem in Park City, what strategy would you have recommended to him?
Well, I initially would have recommended that they not increase their past sales by 7%, I believe it was this year. And they obviously had an image and a branding and a PR problem last year. And I think they needed to probably stabilize their prices to continue to build back loyalty from skiers in both in the community and beyond. And I think they've as a corporation have acknowledged that they haven't really delivered on their promise last year. So I would have liked to see, as a show of goodwill, at least stabilizing the pass prices for this year. But I also understand the cost of doing business is increasing, but 7% seemed like a bit of a jump after a rocky year that they had. But I wish them tons of success, and obviously it's important to the Park City community that Vail and Park City Mountain thrive.
So, okay, what is next for you and Redhead Marketing?
Well, Redhead Marketing and PR is going to continue to build our presence as a local resource for companies who are looking to increase their awareness here in Utah. We work with a lot of national brands who are entering the market and need to build and maintain awareness. So, for example, we work with Walmart. We do all of their local communications for Utah. That's over 55 stores in the state. And they just had a new one open in Eagle Mountain. And then we also work with a lot of local companies who not only need local awareness, but also national attention as well. So some of those include the Gateway down in Salt Lake City, who we've worked with for over 5 years, Promontory Club here in Park City, and Park City Community Foundation, which has their annual Live PC, Give PC event coming up in November, which we have done PR for several years now.
Fantastic. We just spent a few minutes with Hillary Ryder Azzaretti of Redhead Marketing and PR. We learned a lot. We found the need for and the desire for public relations and marketing. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you, Kevin and Roger. It has been a pleasure talking to you as always.
And we'll be right back after this. Many of us have a friend, neighbor, and or acquaintance who has ditched the corporate life, struck out on their own, and worked directly with and for their clients. We're continuing to speak with some of those trailblazers on this show. Our next guests, actually, fit into that arena. As a firefighter and advanced EMT, he worked with a Northern Utah fire department that often was called in for wildland fires. He saw the need for preventative measures in communities that were at risk and formed Apex Fire Preparedness with a partner. We're fortunate enough to have founder Trevor Searle and Bo Wagner on the show this morning. Good morning. Welcome to Mount Money.
Good morning.
Morning.
Thanks for having us.
So let's start with Trevor. Tell us about yourself. What led you into firefighting?
Yeah, I just always wanted to do it growing up and grew up behind a fire department and always saw them rolling out and started doing wildfires during college in the off season, or I guess between semesters, and went from there and started the company with a buddy that I met fighting wildfires, Connor Nelson.
Excellent. Yeah. And you guys worked together fighting wildfires up in northern Utah.
Yep. Yeah, we were based out of Utah County and kind of traveled kind of the western U.S. doing that. Saw how reactive we are in fighting fires and just talked about it one day and realized we were both thinking the same thing and started the business.
Now, in a gig like that, did you do both sort of, you know, urban fires, sort of local fires, as well as the occasional wildfire? How did that sort of department work?
Yeah, we were only doing wildfires. Okay. And then after that, I went and started working for city departments on the ambulance and the engine.
And were you one of those, you know, when you were a little kid at the firehouse with the plastic helmet and throwing on the jacket?
Absolutely. Yeah.
Good. Yeah. And Bo, you graduated University of Utah. Sports management, fire preparedness is a different path. How'd you get there?
It is. I had always had an interest in wildland firefighting, mm-hmm. but I do enjoy my summer free time, and you don't get a lot of that in wildland. So I looked into other avenues. I was working different jobs and then met Trevor actually through the park that we took our dogs to. And he had just started Apex. Just got talking about the business. It was starting to grow. They only had a couple people on board. And he asked if I wanted to come help out one day, work on the job, see if it was a good fit. Came out, worked with these guys, a really tight group of individuals, and it was good work, and just went from there. And it's been a great thing to see the company grow. We've got a really good crew now, and it's been a booming business ever since.
And you get to work outdoors.
Get to be outside. Cannot complain about that.
Excellent.
Only when it's 100 degrees.
So walk us through a typical day. You show up to someone's house, let's say.
Yeah, so we show up to a house. Generally, we've done some bidding before that process. Either Connor, Trevor, or myself has gone out and evaluated the home for potential risks, what can be done in terms of the structure and also the surrounding space, the green space around the home. And we'll basically determine what needs to be done to mitigate fire risk, make a home more protected and safe in case of a fire.
Give us some examples of a typical hardening recommendation or series of recommendations that you would do, Trevor.
Yeah, so looking at the structure, it's what's called home hardening. And a big thing with that is looking at what it's made of. So we don't want shake shingle roofs. We don't want shake shingle siding. A big thing is getting rid of the mulch right around the home, which is quite a hard ask for a lot of people, which is understandable. So replacing that with gravel or nice decorative rock or just bare mineral soil is best for embers. So the statistic is that over 90% of homes burn down from embers instead mm-hmm. of direct flame contact. So looking directly around the home is really important. We're also replacing vents with ember-safe vents. So any foundation vents or attic vents need to be replaced with something with smaller mesh. And what we're using, we use BrandGuard vents. They're out of California. And they have a strip in the vent that when it reaches a certain temperature, the vent will seal itself off to any heat or flames, and they're fire rated for an hour. So they actually did a little case study after the Palisades fire where they replaced all the vents in an HOA, and they had a 96% survival rate in that HOA of homes. The ones that did burn down had a tree that fell on a home or vines growing on a balcony that caught fire and, you know, radiated heat through a window, caught a curtain on fire. There's lots of ways a house can catch on fire in a wildfire. It's not just flames running through. So the embers are big, and protecting those vents is a big step towards mitigating those issues.
And this may be obvious to some people, but I'm trying to figure this out. The concern is that I've got an ember that's flying through the air, floating through the air. It can go into the vent and get into the attic or the basement, and then start a fire at that point.
Correct.
Is that how that works? Okay.
Yeah.
And by sealing it off, the spark doesn't get in.
Correct. Yeah. And typically, it's not a single ember. They call it like an ember storm.
Okay.
Where those winds that are produced from the fire or being driven, or the winds are driving the fire, they're just throwing embers out 1 mile, 2 miles ahead of the flame front. So
1 mile to 2 miles ahead of the flames.
Correct.
Holy cow. I didn't know that.
Okay, so we've sort of talked about the homeowner example. Let's back it up a minute and talk about sort of the range of services you provide. Who are your typical clients?
Generally, private homeowners. We've worked with a number of HOAs up here in Park City, as well as down in the valley as well, like immigration area.
And let's talk about that. When you approach an HOA, do you say, look, these are the kinds of hardening recommendations we recommend, and they have to deal with the complex issue of deciding how much they're going to require people to do? I imagine there's a bit of a dance there.
Yeah, for sure. A lot of people are pretty sensitive to what you take in their yards. They planted these trees and have done a lot of landscaping and put a lot of money into that. So they don't want us to come in and just level the surrounding area and take out their green space and just make their yard just a clear-cut path. So when we come in, we're very selective with our thinning. And ideally, it makes your yard expand and turn into a very well-manicured, natural-looking forest. At first, we kind of tell people it looks like a fresh haircut after we're done. It's going to look very different at first, but then you'll get used to it and you'll actually like it more than how it looked previously. It's not just a tangled mess. It's actually usable space. And so, yeah, we'll just like create some good canopy spacing, reduce some of the ladder fuels on a lot of the trees surrounding the home.
And why would someone want to do this? I mean, the risk of your house burning down in a wildfire is pretty slim. Do they do it for just in case, or do they do it also for possible homeowners insurance reduction?
We haven't seen a super catastrophic wildfire here in Utah, at least not compared to California, but it's definitely trending to getting worse each year. And then even seeing, you know, a few years ago in Colorado in the winter, where it was a wind-driven structure fire, wildfire kind of thing, where it was just continuous homes burning down, that it's not only reducing your risk of a wildfire, but it's reducing your risk in the event of a car fire nearby or another structure fire where you've protected your home. And then worst-case scenario, you've also created a healthier ecosystem around your home. So animals will move in. And like Bo said, it's a lot more usable space. And then with insurance, we've actually been able to save people's home insurance in areas where they get a cancellation notice. We've gone in, done the defensible space. We've done the home hardening, swapped out the vents. And we've brought out an underwriter to show the work that we've done. And they've given the stamp of approval and said, yes, this is a risk we're willing to take with these people because they've done the work, they've invested the time and money. They should keep their insurance.
And have you seen it in the sort of parallel context where I know some people who are purchasing a home have had trouble buying homeowners insurance. Have you seen circumstances where you guys are brought in to try to do that in order to enable coverage to be written in the first place as opposed to avoiding a cancellation?
Yes, we've also been able to get, I think it's 5 homes this year covered with insurance that were initially told no because of the work we've done. So we've been starting to work with brokers and getting kind of referrals from them to be able to help them expand their client base. Especially with the house bill that's coming through, insurance companies are going to be forced to look again at how they insure this area. Homeowners are going to be forced to get assessments and start to put in this work to be able to meet the guidelines that the state's going to start in January.
You know, we're sort of moving toward a regime where just as important as trying to get a mortgage, or actually the key to being able to purchase a home is the combination of being able to get insured so you can get a mortgage. And my guess is you guys are going to end up being more proactive as we see this continuing concern by the various insurers about fire risk.
Correct, yeah. And we're also working with HOAs to be able to make, you know, their entire client, or I guess all their homeowners be able to buy and sell. We're looking at their architectural review guidelines where before they were enforcing that you had to have a shake shingle roof or you had to plant a blue spruce next to the home. A lot of people are frustrated with their HOAs, but really we just didn't know any better. And now we're trying to do better. And it is quite painful, like Bo was saying, to cut some of these trees you've really taken care of. But if we can get HOAs and communities on board with these guidelines, it'll be a safer area. And it might look different, but it'll end up being a lot better in the future.
Okay, so we are a business program. Is there a range of what this costs? I mean, let's say a typical house in Park City, it's, you know, I don't know, 2,500, 3,000 square feet on a quarter acre. And it's in an old neighborhood, so therefore it's got some mature trees. Is that going to cost them more than their homeowner's insurance?
It really depends.
Okay.
I mean, some homes, they do have a lot of vents where we're covering 300 feet of roof line of continuous soffit vents. Other homes have vaulted ceilings and they don't have attic space, so therefore they don't have attic vents, so they don't need to replace them. There's other homes that are kind of in more of a sagebrush area where that's a quick fix with our machines. Others do have overhanging conifers all around their home. So it all depends on where it's at, and then it also depends on their risk tolerance, because in an ideal world, everything's made of cement and there's nothing around it. But if we can play with our risk tolerance of the homeowners, and then also within what we've seen actually fighting wildfires of what makes sense, we can kind of find a happy medium. Hopefully it pays off year after year as they are able to maintain their insurance that they like, and their premiums aren't going up or they're not getting dropped and going with a worse policy, paying more. It'll pay off over time, but it can be quite an intimidating receipt.
Good. And now if any listeners want to get in touch with you to use the home hardening service, or if they want to come work for you, how would they get in touch with you?
Check out our website.
Which is?
apex-fp.com.
And are you guys on social media at all?
Yes, we are.
Okay.
We're on Instagram.
Do people find you there?
We're trying to be better at keeping people up to date with Instagram and all that stuff, because we do cool stuff. We, you know, get to cut big trees. We're working up in Deer Valley with the new ski resort expansion. We're finishing up 30 acres of cutting, and we'll be burning it all winter. We do a lot of stream restoration. We do rangeland restoration. So we're doing fun stuff, and we're trying to keep people up to date with what we're doing, and it's going to be helpful trying to get employees in the future as well to see what we're doing and get excited.
So Trevor Searle and Bo Wagner of Apex Fire Preparedness, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
And we'll be right back after this. This was a great episode of Mountain Money. Thank you very much for joining us.
We'd also like to thank our guests. We started with Professor Katie Keith of Georgetown University. We then got to chat with Hillary Ryder Azzaretti of Redhead Marketing and PR. And we finished our hour by talking to Trevor Searle and Bo Wagner of Apex Fire Preparedness.